You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
AMD investigates a report of exploitable flaws in its processors. Vietnamese threat actor Ocean Lotus gets a look from researchers. We've got some Patch Tuesday notes. Britain expels Russian diplomats in retaliation for a nerve agent attack. Russia demands to know what these cyber attacks are that the UK is said to be threatening. A brief history of Russo-British 21st century espionage and cyber tensions. And Iranian threat actor Muddy Waters threatens researchers. I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Wednesday, March 14, 2018. Significant flaws in AMD processors have been reported by CTS Labs, a hitherto little-known Israeli firm. AMD says it's investigating, but also says it had never heard of CTS Labs, and that CTS gave AMD only a day's warning before going public. This is, of course, far shorter than the 60 to 90 days most companies tend to follow. Google's Project Zero, for example, uses 90 days. How quickly a flaw might be made public can depend upon other things, too. A present danger to public safety might well warrant swift public disclosure, but that doesn't seem to be the case here. The flaws, which affect EPYC, Ryzen, Ryzen Pro, and Ryzen Mobile processors, require admin rights for exploitation. It is possible for attackers to gain admin rights in various ways, so that's not an insurmountable obstacle to exploitation. CTS Labs calls the vulnerabilities Master Key, Ryzen Fall, Fallout, and Chimera. Assessment of the details is difficult. CTS Labs redacted much technical information to prevent its use by bad actors. Security experts differ in their judgment of the problem's severity, but few seem willing to defend the way the vulnerabilities were disclosed. ESET and others have been tracking Ocean Lotus, also known as APT-32 or Cobalt Kitty. The threat group operates for the most part against targets in Southeast Asia. Cambodia, Laos, and the Philippines are said to be particularly affected. It shows some sophistication in its approach and operations. Yesterday was March's Patch Tuesday. Adobe issued its regular ritualistic patches of Flash Player, and if you use Flash Player, you should apply them. Microsoft came out with 14 updates that, by Krebs on Security's estimation, covered more than 75 vulnerabilities. Ivanti puts the number at 78. Redmond's patches affect all the still-supported Windows versions, and also Explorer, Edge, Office, SharePoint, and Exchange Server. The critical vulnerabilities addressed are said to be in browsers and related software. Mozilla Firefox and Firefox ESR also issued patches. They rate their updates as critical and say they've fixed 21 vulnerabilities. Do you use a VPN to access your corporate network remotely? Plenty of people do, and it's widely considered a good practice for security and privacy reasons. Patrick Sullivan is Director of Security Tech and Strategy at Akamai, and he joins us to outline some of the challenges of VPN use and why the notion of verify and never trust is a core principle worth consideration.
You know, VPN is sort of a broad term. There are VPNs, you know, for point-to-point connectivity between offices. We won't talk about that today. I think we'll talk about the category of VPNs that are used to provide remote access. So I think, you know, really what we're seeing is at one time sort of VPNs were, if not the exclusive, certainly the dominant technology used to provide remote access. And if we look at sort of the assumptions that went into that, there was sort of a network perimeter-based model that almost everybody implemented. And really in that model, you saw users and apps inside sort of a trusted network segment, typically in a corporate data center. And then there was some form of network perimeter that would separate the trusted segment of the network, which was on private IPs, from the untrusted public internet. Some people call this sort of a castle and moat architecture. Hmm. And VPN was the preferred technology that would be used to extend that interior of the castle and moat, if you will, to one of our trusted employees who happened to be outside of the four walls of that corporate office, so to extend that castle and moat to somebody's remote location and give them trusted network layer access that they could use to access corporate applications.
So you all are advocating this principle of verify and never trust. Can you take us through what that means?
We're certainly one voice of many there. So I think, you know, when you look at kind of the traditional, you know, VPNs are kind of what we're talking about today, somebody would connect in to that VPN for the duration of that session, maybe 8 hours. And at that point, we've decided that we trust them on that VPN session. If somebody walks into our office, they're an employee, they connect into an Ethernet port or a corporate Wi-Fi, we're trusting them at the network layer. So really that level of trust at the network layer is dangerous. We've seen that. I think there are a number of voices out there. You know, Forrester with zero trust. Gartner talks about Carta, and really they speak about the risk of trying to make a perfect macro level security decision. You know, specifically in this case, to give somebody network layer access on a VPN for the next 8 hours. Right, that's a macro level decision. Hmm. And I think the opposite of that is to not trust at the network layer, to proxy each and every request, to inspect those and to consider identity, to consider least privilege, which applications does somebody need to perform their job, you know, based on their role in the organization, you know, potentially, you know, doing simple things like multi-factor authentication as well as part of that configuration.
So take us through, what are you advocating in terms of implementing this sort of thing? I have to say, it sounds more complicated than what we were dealing with earlier, but is it in fact?
I don't think so, right? So I think if you look at the way this would work, in many cases, what you have is an access proxy. So rather than a network layer device that drops you into a trusted network segment, an end user would point their browser to a proxy. You know, DNS will direct them there. And then that proxy will have information about their identity in that organization, and part of that identity would be their role, their job description. So it's actually in many ways it's simpler to set up and it's faster. I think when Akamai first embarked on this, we were up and running, and we first looked at third-party retailers, and we had a system up in place in hours because it is a SaaS-based model in the cloud, which takes away a lot of the challenges of rack and stack.
That's Patrick Sullivan from Akamai. Taking a quick look at our CyberWire event tracker, coming up is the third annual Billington International Cybersecurity Summit. That's going to be on March 21st at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And if you're in the Denver area next week, on March 22nd, the Cybersecurity Summit is coming up. You can get 50% off your admission with the code CyberWire50 on their website, cybersummitusa.com. To find out more about these events and to get your event listed, head on over to thecyberwire.com/events. The UK is expelling 23 Russian diplomats in retaliation for the attempted assassination of a former GRU officer. Russia offered no explanation, beyond denial, before last night's midnight deadline, instead demanding explanation of rumors that the UK is considering retaliatory cyber attacks against Russia. Prime Minister May has said she will consider the full range of measures available to retaliate against Russia. Business Insider has a useful quick summary of what that range looks like. First, expulsion of Russian diplomats. This has been done, with 23 of them declared persona non grata. Second, formal withdrawal of official UK presence at the upcoming World Cup to be held in Russia. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has suggested this. It seems likely to happen. Third, withdrawal of credentials from RT, the Russia Today news service. Ofcom, the independent British communications regulator, is considering pulling RT's license, and many observers think it likely to do so. If it does, Russia is likely to kick British news services out of Russia. Fourth, cyber attacks against Russia assets. This one is risky, but it's also an option that Home Secretary Amber Rudd has hinted at in the past. It's also the option Russia has itself demanded an explanation of. Britain is a capable cyber power, and it's difficult to imagine London and Moscow actually wanting to swap punches in cyberspace. On the other hand, the Five Eyes have all recently attributed NotPetya to the Russian government, and British companies figured prominently among the victims of that campaign, so there may be some sense that the battle's already been drawn. Fifth, freezing the assets of Russian oligarchs. The conservative government has come under pressure from Labour, and also from others, to enact some version of the U.S. Magnitsky Act, which would enable the freezing or forfeiture of Russian assets. The government has been reluctant to do so, but this sort of retaliation would certainly hit what influence Russians value. Her Majesty's government is asking for a UN Security Council meeting to address what it regards with reason as a Russian chemical attack on British soil. 22 people were treated for exposure to nerve agent. Three, the two targets, Sergei Skripal and his daughter, and a British first responder, remain under treatment. A few hundred others in the vicinity of the attacks were offered decontamination. Another Russian, businessman Nikolai Glushkov, a fugitive from Russian justice in an Aeroflot embezzlement case and a witness in the Litvinenko assassination, which also happened in the UK, died under unexplained circumstances Tuesday in his London home. Police report signs of strangulation. Of course, Russian wet operations are widely suspected, and authorities in the UK are investigating the death as a possible act of terrorism. Alexander Litvinenko was a former FSB officer and defector who became a naturalized British subject. On November 1, 2006, Litvinenko was hospitalized for what was diagnosed as exposure to polonium-210. The dose proved lethal. Litvinenko died 3 weeks later. If Sergei Skripal and his daughter were hit with a chemical weapon, Litvinenko fell victim to a radiological one. The Muddy Water Threat Group, generally associated with Iran, also seems newly disposed to play rough. Trend Micro researchers probing a server connected to the group received a message in stereotypical terrorist lingo right out of the scriptwriter's world. Stop. Kill you, researcher. Normally, one would laugh this kind of thing off as skid nonsense, but anyone might be excused any additional wariness they might feel in the wake of what's been happening in the UK. And joining me once again is Justin Harvey. He's the Global Incident Response Leader at Accenture. Justin, welcome back. You know, I have often heard that when you suffer a data breach, time is of the essence. And you wanted to make the point today that those first 48 hours are really critical.
Yeah, many times you don't really know if you have an incident. And when you get that first alert or when you get the first notification, the clock really starts ticking. So during that first 48 hours, you've got to do a few things. Number one is you've got to triage and see exactly what you have. Is it nation state? Is it cryptocurrency malware? Is it cyber criminal? Is it a ransomware? And once you establish what that type of malware is or what that incident is, then you need to go into incident response mode, assuming that it is characterized as an incident. And it's really critical that you follow your incident response procedures and actually that they are developed up front. Mm. What we're seeing many times is that during that first 48, there is a bit of a let's throw caution and the plan that we've worked on for the last few years or that we've always kept in this little box ready to go break in case of cyber emergency. And all that goes out the door. But it's critically important that you spend the time up front and drill around a strong incident response plan. It's also important to have a retainer, to be able to reach out to another firm or organization to get help. And a lot of times what I have seen is that there's a cyber crisis or cyber incident and the company or the enterprise hasn't prepared in getting all of the necessary paperwork done for having that incident response retainer for outside help. And what ends up happening is there is a deluge of vendors. If it becomes public, there's a deluge of vendors trying to get their foot in the door and tell you about their solution, their service, their people that can help you. And assuming that you do pick an incident response vendor during this first 48, then you're going to go into legal hell. Your own legal team will be amped up, wanting to review everything because there's an active incident. And can you imagine trying to get an incident response retainer or incident response contract done in that period of time? So you're going to go back and forth on red lines around liability, around data protection classifications, how your data is handled and where it's stored. You don't want to do that up front. You want to be able to have that retainer in place beforehand so that it's as simple as picking up the phone and dialing an incident response company and saying, I need your services right now.
Yeah, and it strikes me that so much of this, I think when something like this happens, there's a natural tendency for people to be emotional. Something bad has happened. And the more you can plan ahead of time to help keep yourselves out of that emotional state, that probably the better off you're going to be.
Absolutely. When you're going off half-cocked, if you're going off and not properly framing the problem and thinking about it in a deliberate manner, you are at risk of making some poor decisions. For instance, one of the things that is very commonplace in the industry is don't destroy the evidence, meaning if you have an incident, don't turn the machine off and don't ship it in its shutdown state to somewhere else for examination. You want to put the system in hibernation mode. Mm-hmm. By putting it in hibernation mode, that gets it off the network. It is essentially sleeping, and you're able to preserve the memory for future analysis.
Oh, I see. So your volatile memory is an important part of assessing what's happened as well.
Absolutely. We're seeing more and more fileless-based attacks, meaning attacks that are only resident within memory. A lot of these are PowerShell-based in nature, and it's very difficult to go back in time without that volatile memory.
Yeah. All right. Good advice as always. Justin Harvey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Puru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.